Hello, listener. Welcome back to the Side B Anthology. For the next installment of Vintage Library, in which we will continue to read The Princess and the Plowman. And we're on chapter 3 now. So without further ado, let's get into the reading. Chapter 3. If the truth must be told, Miss Vivian had been gradually finding out that her friendship with Mary Adams had grown into something very like an actual embarrassment. It had commenced like an ivy climbing up a wall, delicate, slight, ready to wither and die at an unfriendly touch, reaching up timid tendrils, frail as mist, yet fascinating and clinging, blindingly, tenaciously, almost suffocatingly. By almost imperceptible degrees, she had found herself isolated, hemmed in, held unyieldingly fast by the unswerving devotion of Mary. It was very sweet, no doubt, to have won the wholehearted adoration of so exquisite and guileless a creature. But for her part, Felice Vivian was sanely aware of the unreality, to herself she called it plainly absurdity, of the relation. She recognized the fact that the whole fabric of this chilly maiden love was fashioned out of unsubstantial dream stuff, as lovely but every whit as evanescent as the frost flowers of a winter morning etched upon a pane of clear glass. She was herself already conscious of warm desires and ambitions wholly without the jealous clasp of Mary's strong white arms. Reasoning in a healthy, girlish fashion from cause to effect, Miss Vivian set deliberately about supplanting herself in Mary's heart. To be really in love, she argued, one must be in love with a man. In pursuance of her deep designs for Mary's ultimate well-being, she invited her for a long stay at her father's country place, and here she guilefully caused various eligible men to appear in due succession, and upon each, in turn, she conscientiously strove to impress the superlative attractions of her guest. This altruistic endeavor was foredoomed to complete failure. Mary had never looked more beautiful, yet in her absolute aloofness and tranquil unconsciousness of her charm, she made no more impression upon the hearts of the men than an exquisite child. They agreed with cheerful unanimity that Miss Adams was a star, then straightway fell in love with their hostess, who was merely an adorable human being. After a third ignominious failure of the sort, Miss Vivian unflinchingly resorted to severer measures. "Do you know, honey, I am feeling wretchedly unhappy about you," she began with a solemnity that roused Mary to tender alarms. "Unhappy about me? Oh, Felice, what have I done?" entreated Mary. "Was it because... did you think, dearest, that I talked too much to that Mr. Calthorpe who was here last week? You know you were always leaving us together, and I tried to be polite to him for your sake." "Oh, honey, how that is, I wanted you to talk to him. I wanted you to like him. Can't you see what a dreadful mistake you are making? Your 23rd birthday comes next year, and unless you marry somebody before then, you will lose your Aunt Lydia's money, and that will mean losing me too." She added the last words with deliberate emphasis. "Must I lose you?" whispered Mary. "Oh, why?" Miss Vivian steeled herself against the appealing beauty of the petitioner's eyes. "I am thinking only of what is best for you, Mary," she said crisply. "I have felt for a long time that I am really in your way, and I don't mean to be selfish any longer." She paused to look at Mary's imploring face, then added, with calculating cruelty, "I am very fond of you, Mary, and I always shall be, but it is nonsense to suppose that we shall always live together. We couldn't, you see." "But the college, Felice," pleaded Mary. "Surely you haven't forgotten all our plans. You know you promised to stay with me always, always, Felice, and we have arranged the courses of study and how the girls are to wear gowns of pink and white and yellow and blue instead of plain black. You can't have forgotten." Miss Vivian shrugged her slim shoulders impatiently. "It was very amusing to talk about," she admitted, "but as a matter of fact, you must remember, my dear, that we could do nothing of the sort without a lot of money, and that you are determined not to have." "I have thought of it all over and over again," persisted poor Mary, winking back her tears. "I am really not so foolish as you seem to think, Felice. Even if the money goes to a board of trustees instead of to me, I see no reason why we may not carry out our plans. I wrote to my guardian and asked him if he would arrange for you to be president of the college and for me to be dean." "And what did Mr. Chantrey say in reply?" inquired Miss Vivian, arching her brows with a pitying smile. "He is very sarcastic and unpleasant, as usual," sighed Mary. "Still, I haven't given up hope. We shall have to wait, for a long time perhaps, but I shall not mind if you won't, darling. This is his letter."
"My dear Mary, I am sorry to see that in your case the so-called higher education does not appear to have developed in the least your sense of relativity, ordinarily called common sense. Your scheme is a very pretty one, and quite what I should have expected from you, but unfortunately the only way you can be sure of doing as you wish is to comply with the conditions of your Aunt Lydia Adams' will. If you care to consider my advice, you will accept Jerome, who is still in the market and doubtless available. As for the presidency of that hypothetical college, while you would undoubtedly be able to wield considerable influence in the selection of its official head, that influence must be brought to bear upon the proper persons at the proper time and place. I have the honor, madam, to remain very respectfully yours, Isaac Chantrey."
"Would you consider Jerome if he should offer himself again?" inquired Miss Vivian after a discreet pause.
"You know that I would not," said Mary. She returned the letter to its envelope, her white hands trembling a little. Then she fixed her clear eyes upon her friend.
"Are you tired of me, Felice?" she asked. "Do you want me to go away?" These two questions quite exactly expressed what Miss Vivian was thinking at that minute. She was tired of Mary, and she wished heartily that she would go away, somewhere, anywhere, with her embarrassing devotion and her childish, impossible plans. But she did what 99 women out of 100 would have done in like circumstances. As she looked into Mary's lovely, beseeching eyes, all the tenderness and pity of a nature which was, after all, hard only at the core, after the highly respectable pattern of a peach or a plum, welled over in murmured words and gentle caresses. She called Mary her dear old honeypot, her sweetest love, her dearest, dearest of darlings. She assured her, unblushingly, that she should be very, very unhappy, actually heartbroken indeed, if parted from her Mary, and ended by offering to do her hair in a new way. All of which soothed poor Mary into a lovely glow of happiness and gratitude, in which she appeared more than ever like a big, beautiful child. That afternoon, Mary went out by herself to think, she told Felice gravely, and the latter accepted her transient release with a little shrug of mingled gratitude and pity. The place which Mary chose as a trysting place with her confused thoughts could hardly have been more beautiful, but neither purple seas nor the rich variety of woodland and meadow spread out under a sky of loveliest azure held any answer to the puzzling questions which appeared to demand immediate solution. In her own peculiarly slow and illogical way, Mary had arrived at one or two tardy conclusions. She must either marry, she told herself, or give up her plans for a college in Hawaii. Her Aunt Lydia's fortune did not matter except as it linked itself with Felice. Linked with Felice, the despised legacy took on an appearance of supreme importance. She set herself to consider the hated condition attached to the bequest, with a deliberation and seriousness which she had not yet brought to it. It had been indistinctly impressed upon her mind that a wife should love her husband. How this phenomenon was even remotely possible, she could scarcely imagine. Men, as they had hitherto appeared to her abstracted eyes, were ugly creatures, overgrown, uncouth, awkward. Their deep voices grated upon her ear, their bold eyes roused her to vague alarms and vaguer indignations. She shivered in the warm summer air as Jerome Chantrey's full-fed, middle-aged, complacent visage rose before her mental vision. He appeared to bend gloatingly over her. He was about to touch her cheek with his lips. She sprang to her feet with a little scream of terror and hatred. Afar off in the valley at her feet, a man clad in dull blues was at work among the young corn. Mary's unhappy thoughts fluttered to this distant figure quite unawares and hovered about it uncertainly. After a while, she walked slowly down the hill. What she was thinking as she went, she could not possibly have explained to herself or to anyone. Her large eyes were fastened upon the blue-shirted figure. She moved steadily towards it. Down in the valley, the blue-shirted man was working busily among the springing ranks of young corn. The green blades were as yet quite small and slender, and about their roots crept various wild plants, bearing a profusion of tiny common flowers, yellow and white and pink. The man was dislodging these gay vagrants with a light cut and thrust of his sharp hoe. Now and again he stooped to pull one from its chosen foothold next the growing corn. He appeared determined to spare none of them, yet a curious regret clouded his keen eyes as he struck hither and yon at the tender things, the dull clink of his hoe against the loose stones making a subdued accompaniment to his thoughts, which ran musically in a single narrow channel. Where her delicate feet had touched the earth, green herbage flowering sprang, he repeated. He could not, for the life of him, recall the second line. There was both love and longing in it, he knew, pursuing someone as she had pursued the flying pages of her manuscript. Green herbage flowering sprang, he again repeated to himself, with a tolerant smile at his own folly, and stooped to pull a fragrant pink clover upon which a wandering bee had settled. The man fixed his blue eyes upon it thoughtfully, the remembered vision of the slender young figure in its rose-colored gown linking itself curiously with the flower and its eager bee. No one save a poet could possibly have thought the thoughts the blue-shirted man was thinking while Mary was walking slowly toward him across the fields, not knowing whither she was going, nor yet why she went. No one save a gentleman, in the primal, unspoiled meaning of the word, could have watched her approach with prophetic eyes which seemed to see beyond the present into the long vistas of past and future. There you have it. Chapter 3. Well, right off the bat, We have Felice confirming my suspicions from the previous chapter in that she definitely does not have the same feelings towards Mary that Mary has towards her. And unfortunately, instead of just being very clear about that, she's going to all sorts of lengths to try and and get Mary to focus on someone else without actually telling her that she doesn't want Mary's focus on her. I suppose it is something that happens pretty often, I think, because of course it's, well, as we see in this chapter, she does care for Mary. She just doesn't love her back in the same way, and she doesn't really want to hurt Mary, so she tries to do the gentler thing and kind of get her to redirect her own feelings. But when, I mean, the fact that Mary genuinely loves her, she wouldn't just redirect her own feelings unless she knew that Felice didn't love her back. And one thing that I really appreciated at the beginning of this chapter is the fact that the narrative makes very clear that it is specifically Felice's opinion that real love can only be between a man and a woman. And it's not necessarily, it seems, what the author believes, and of course what Mary believes, because Mary is very clearly in love. I also like that we're kind of tying a thread from chapter 1 to the end of chapter 3 by reintroducing the character that caught the pages of what had blown away out of Mary's hands in that first chapter. Who I think it's probably safe to assume is the plowman from the title of the book, because she was described, was it in the first or second chapter, she was compared to a medieval princess. So I think that's, maybe these are the characters that the romance is going to blossom between, because he's presented, or it's hinted at, the fact that he has poetic sense. He is a poet. It seems like he's trying to compose a poem by memory while he's working the fields. And it seems like it might be a poem about Mary herself from their chance meeting at the beginning of the book. So I guess to kind of sum up my thoughts about this chapter, it is really disappointing that already we're seeing this breakdown of the sapphic romance that was presented front and center in chapter 2. But I do very much appreciate the fact that that it's made very clear that Mary's love is genuine, Mary's love for a woman is genuine, and that it is Felice that does not believe that genuine love is possible between two women. So the story is not presenting their relationship as being doomed because they're women. It's really showing that they're just really not compatible, which in a sense is good. I don't know where I'm going with that thought exactly. Yeah, so I guess that's kind of the crux of it, that it's not demonizing, sapphic relationships themselves. It's really looking at this specific relationship and this specific person that is not taking the relationship seriously. Another thing that I really like is that it doesn't appear as though, even though there are all these there are these people that are attempting to manipulate her into doing what they want. She is consistently refusing to be manipulated, is not, and is kind of maintaining her integrity the entire time. So that makes her a very likable, compelling character so far, to me. Obviously, that's my opinion. You don't need to share it. I really do think that Felice leading her on in this way and not having the courage to just weather Mary's hurt or disappointment and just say the truth is rather condescending to Mary. She constantly characterizes her with words like childish and guileless and even in, it might not have been obvious in my reading, but she was going to call her stupid at the beginning of the chapter and then kind of cut herself off and reformulated what she was saying. But I don't think any of those words actually apply to her if you really think about it, because in what way is she being childish? She's looking at the situation that she's in, and she has devised a way to control her own life and control her own fate and not be ruled by anyone else. She's being rather mature about it, and there's nothing childish about loving someone wholeheartedly. I think that's more an issue with Felice on her end at not being able to be honest with herself and with Mary. In any case, I would feel very satisfied if whoever it is that Mary ends up with, that we see that this person that she ends up with actually admires those qualities in her, instead of seeing them as character flaws the way that Felice and Judge Chantry also seem to. So that is what I'm hoping for. I don't know if that's what we'll get as we continue to read, but I'm looking forward to finding out. So far, I'm really getting into this story now. I really do wonder if my grandma read this or if it just kind of sat in her house, but I'm really hoping she read it, and maybe more than once, who knows. All right, I've mused and rambled enough. I think we'll end it there for this episode. So, if you're listening to this in the morning, then good morning. I hope you have a great day today. And even if you have a lot to do, I hope you find some time to relax at some point during the day or night. And if you're listening to this at night, then good night. I hope you have a really relaxing sleep. And I'll see you next time. Bye.